Empowering innovation, the Rockwell Automation vision for future-ready EV battery supply chains. Dear audience, my name is Ludmila Dehr. I'm the Managing Director of Elite Experts Conferences, and I would like to welcome you to the next episode of the Elite Experts Conferences podcast. Whether at live events or in the digital world, we bring together cool, promising tech startups with exciting, innovative global players and generate a platform where the world of sustainable technology meets. Get to know the different companies, but also the inspiring leader personalities behind these brand names. Our motto is towards a better and cleaner future through knowledge transfer and technology. Today we have exciting guests on the podcast again, who are ready to answer my curious and occasionally even challenging questions. So let me introduce our guests from Rockwell Automation. We have Ted Stockberger as Global Director of Electric Vehicle and Advanced Mobility today. Our second guest is Pierre Tessner as Regional VP of Sales for Central Europe. And our third guest is today Christian Leitner as Business Leader, Future Mobility EMEA. Welcome, welcome, welcome. And before we dive into the panel discussion, I would love to give our audience a quick introduction about the Rockwell Automation itself. Rockwell Automation is a global leader in digital transformation and, of course, industrial automation. And they work with various industries beyond automotive. The major business fields of Rockwell Automation include control systems and automation, industrial software, motion control, sensors, safety, industrial networking, power control, and electrical components, and many, many more. So, and now let's start with our panel discussion, Empowering Innovation, the Rockwell Automation Vision for Future-Ready EV Battery Supply Chains. Let's start. My first question is directed to all of you. I would like to do a slightly more entertaining round of introductions with you. So, well, Ted, you have your background in electrical engineering. Pierre, you studied aerospace engineering. And Christian, your background is in industrial engineering. And now I will formulate these questions, let's say perhaps a little unexpectedly. What part of your initial knowledge you had to unlearn, and what did you have to learn completely from zero for your current role? So what is it? Ted, would you like to start?
Interesting question to start us off. Well, I'll say for myself, it's been a handful of decades since I've been at university, and I'm not sure what I had to unlearn, but I certainly remember I really felt like I had a grasp for obviously the basics and technology, and I was going to go out and change the world, and immediately went to work for a big mining company. After that, a food and beverage company. It was really eye-opening to see the use of technology in manufacturing. And I'm not sure what I thought. I thought I understood what that might look like or feel like or the value that I would bring to that. And it completely changed my worldview to see how things are made and just simply how complicated it is to do that. And it left a mark on me. I've spent my entire career in manufacturing, but I guess I wasn't prepared for what was out there. And I loved what I found. And I've been there ever since.
So, Pierre, let's continue with your introduction. So what did you have to unlearn or learn from zero for your current role?
Yeah, I think, you know, coming from a French diploma engineer background, right, in aerospace, working in military for the first few years, also after my technical education, I think I would say the following thing. I learned a lot about mechanics of fluids, thermodynamics, and all these type of things in subsonic and supersonic, and that was my thesis as well, the subject of my thesis. And to be honest, I after maybe the first few years only of when I worked in the military industry, I had to unlearn this. This did not, it was not really very helpful for the rest of my career, right? All these equations, all these very complex mathematical calculations, and computer aided as well. So, but what I had to learn from scratch was how to cope with people, right? Because in technical education, at least in France, it's maybe a little bit kind of old fashioned, but we don't learn necessarily how to work in teams, how to get the most of other people working in concert with each other. And I had to learn it from scratch. And I think I had the same impression when I did my MBA as well, right? When I went during the MBA and after the MBA, it was the same type of transformation, right? You use a certain framework when you're in a university or a B school, and eventually after you have to apply, and then it becomes a people's interaction kind of game and dynamic. And you're not necessarily prepared because you've dealt with the framework on the theoretical part in the school, but then after you have to put that in music, right, in a way, and to orchestrate that with other people. And then you're depending on how good you are in interacting with others. And I think that's what I had to almost learn from scratch and discover myself, how potentially a little bit awkward I was at the beginning with that. And then step by step, you know, by trying and trying and trying and becoming better at it, I think that's where I am today. But I'm definitely the composite of both, learning education, for the theoretical one and the learning on the ground.
I actually saw that Ted was snorting when you mentioned that, the people factor. Actually, Ted, would you like to add, let's say, that it was similar experience, that is also not in anyhow taught at the university level?
It really resonates with me. It didn't occur to me to bring that up as a major factor, but certainly then and even today, people do business with people. We all work for companies and we all have a role. But what you learn very quickly is who you are, how you talk, the people you interact with, just being a human being is such a big factor in all of that. And you take it for granted, but there's a lot of skills that you can learn and develop to be more effective. So yeah, I think Pierre had a very important point.
And Pierre, does it make actually you a little bit more humble now, because you learned that in the first role, let's say, how to work with people? Then at the MBA you learned the next level of working with people. Do you now, let's say, like, humble to see, like, oh, there's maybe another step?
I think the more you learn about techniques, about skills within a school, the more humble, the bigger the mandate is to be humble. Right? Because I think if the more you learn, the more arrogant you can potentially become, then this is going definitely in the wrong direction. To bring to bear and to really leverage fully what you've learned in a school, right? And the more you know, what I've learned really is you can only communicate and get the most out of a team's work, right? Only if you are just one among others. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when you're the boss, you're probably the first among equals, right? As the Romans said, right, 2,000 years ago, right? So I think it's important to realize that the more you learn, the more you have a duty almost of being humble and listen more.
And in the end, ego is something that differentiates, let's say, the weak characters from the strong ones, no? So in my opinion, again. So now, Christian, join the conversation. So what did you have to unlearn, or what did you have to learn from zero in your experience?
Yeah, quite uncommon question, what I had to unlearn. Honestly, I'm not even so sure whether it's really possible to unlearn things. So for me, it's really more about adapting to new challenges, or maybe also changing certain behaviors and patterns if you enter a new role. So for example, I started my career in engineering. And if you work as an engineer, you are kind of almost in a closed environment, working on your development, also with CRD, doing your calculations similar as what Pierre described. And I think for my second half of my career and also in my current role, I had to unlearn or learn to pay less attention to certain details and rather focus on the big picture and on a wider scope. And of course, I think one of the most important parts was really dealing with people, networking internally and externally, So that's typically something that you do not really require in an engineering type of job. And building that relationship, I think that's really key for everything that you do. What I also had to learn from zero or from scratch on, I would say, in particular when I joined Rockwell, I really had to learn a lot from scratch on, because I was a complete newcomer in the automotive industry. I joined Rockwell in the global automotive industry team. And I was in oil and gas before, in the process industry, to be a little bit more specific. And that was quite a challenge, because those industries do not have much in common, to be honest. So I really had to learn all the details about the manufacturing processes, how a vehicle is made. Of course, there was a ton of industry knowledge that you have to acquire, and this is not something that you can do overnight. It really requires multiple years, meet multiple people, multiple companies, lots of conversations, and then you're slowly starting to figure out who are the key players and much, much more. So I would say that was one of the biggest challenges that I haven't regretted for now or by now.
But at least it sounds like it was never a boring day out there at Rockwell.
No, absolutely not. So it's new things almost every day, I have to say.
So actually, even I started quite unusually with this slightly different introduction, but we gave this panel discussion a title, Empowering Innovation, the Rockwell Automation Vision for Future-Ready EV Battery Supply Chains. Believe it or not, no? It's still in the topic. No? So Ted, before we talk about the future, would you like to tell me and our audience, actually, where Rockwell Automation stands on this topic in the present?
Well, I like to say that Rockwell is the apple that no one knows about. I think of all the times I've tried to explain to my neighbors, my family, my friends, what I do for a living. And really nobody in the public sphere, consumers, really have heard or know anything about Rockwell Automation. And we're the largest industrial-only automation company in the world. We're surrounded by technology. We touch every part of every product that gets made in the world, which is what is so fascinating about what we do. But again, as I said at the beginning, really no one knows about us. And so we struggle to bring people in and to help them understand that. But I'm really happy and proud to be a part of this company. Obviously, I've been here 25 plus years, but It's an interesting company that it does so many interesting things, and so few have or will ever know who we are, what we do.
I have actually now a parallel picture of that. You know, like I see, like it's a little bit comparison to breathing. You only notice the oxygen when it's lacking, right? So like it's a little bit like Rockwell Automation is actually everywhere, really. Like in the introduction, as I said, like you work in kind of every possible market in every possible industry everywhere. Wow. So now we have to change that at least for the automotive part. No? So now Pierre, as we heard now the overview of the current situation, like, being aware of, not aware of Rockwell Automation. So could you tell us a little bit about the future plans and goals before we go more into the details in the panel?
Yeah, sure, I'd be happy to. So in my position today, I lead sales, right, in probably the bigger part of Europe, right, the Central and Eastern Europe. And what I see today is that this is a transformation that is happening, right? We've been talking about, Ted talked about a company that has a huge impact on the automation industry since 120 years. When I'm talking about a transformation, when I joined Rockwell 8 years ago, right, I don't have 25 years experience like Ted, but I can see, coming from a different company before, also in the automation field, Schneider Electric, I can see a definite, determination of Rockwell moving from a past in equipping and helping our customers in the hardware, right, with hardware systems and products, right, and moving into, from selling products in hardware area into selling solutions, into a combination of solutions between hardware and software. And what I'm talking about the transformation is, and you're asking about my future plans, I would say, for me, I would say that I see my role as developing this business to scale, to full potential, right? I see this transformation is still, I would say it's not in the early stages, is we are in the, in it's work in progress, but we still need to have a lot of leadership, a lot of mentoring, a lot of coaching in our sales force and with the rest of the organization to bring the best of what Rockwell has to offer to be the most sustainable, the most productive, right? The lifelong partner of our customers in the area. And I'm sure we'll talk about that later around sustainability, productivity, and security, right? And this is not something like a transformation that happens overnight. You need a lot of persistence. You need a lot of showing and not telling, and you need to embark the rest of the organization in a very concerted and programmatic manner to make it, you know, to bring to bear and in front of a customer and to make it beneficial for the customer.
Actually, when I combine those both answers, so first of all, make it visible what is done. And as you said, like by showing and not just telling. And the other one is like scaling. Huh? So make it big. So now, Christian, I have a question for you. So your area of responsibility is actually future mobility EMEA. And in order for a company like Rockwell Automation to plan strategically, you need to analyze and you need to understand what the future mobility will actually look like in the next few years. So now look in your crystal ball and tell us, what will we be facing in the next 5 to 10 years from now on?
Sure. So this is a very exciting topic, of course. And I have to say, 5 and in particular 10 years is a very long period because it's such a dynamic industry at the moment and there is so many changes. But let me make an attempt and start with the most obvious things that we can observe on the market and then go a little bit deeper. So I think by now, pretty much everybody has realized that all vehicles, everything that is somehow powered by fossil fuels is currently replaced by an electrified powertrain. So I'm thinking about electric vehicles, right? It's quite obvious. And it's also no surprise that we are expecting that the adoption of electric vehicles is going to, you know, grow significantly. This is, of course, also driven by the next generation of batteries. So the battery technology will improve significantly. Costs will be reduced further. And this is, of course, all driven by environmental concerns as well. Along with electric vehicles, I believe it's also going to be more common that we will see more autonomous self-driving vehicles on the road, not necessarily on every road. I'm thinking more about controlled environments. Think about delivery services, think about campuses, shorter distances, or certain city areas where it makes sense. Another thing, I believe, in terms of shared mobility, everybody by now is also familiar with Uber. We use it a lot. There is other shared ride-sharing services like Lyft. And I think this is also going to expand significantly in the future. So it's most likely Uber and Lyft may expand further, but there might be also additional players coming to the market with different services. And I think we sometimes also forget a little bit about the other vehicles on the road, or in particular in urban areas. So there is a huge market and a huge demand for micromobility. So micromobility for me is e-scooters, it's e-bikes, it's e-skateboards, and plenty of other vehicles that you can use to do shorter trips within a city or different areas. And if you look at those vehicles, they are basically powered by the same batteries as a passenger car, or like a truck, a bus, a cylindrical lithium-ion battery cell. So that's also something I believe that is worth exploring a little bit more. Then with shared mobility, of course, I think mobility as a service is going to become more and more important. So I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, Bond, but it's basically integration of multiple different services. So it's not just using your car. You can use an app. You define, okay, I want to go from A to B. And then the service or the app will actually figure out for you what is the most comfortable, what is the most cost efficient, what is the most CO2 efficient way to get there by using train, bus, an e-scooter, a car, depending on the distance. So that's one thing. And of course, with that mobility as a service, there will be more subscription models. So that means you can opt in, opt out for different things, depending on your needs, scale up, scale down. I think another thing that we can observe already today is a shift in ownership. So that means, yeah, in particular, the younger generation, they do not care too much anymore about owning their own car. A couple of decades ago, it was different, I would say, but now that has changed a little bit. So we can see a decline of car ownership, in particular in urban areas where you have public transport and those kind of things available. Again, maybe I have to be a little bit more specific. I'm talking more about the EMEA region now. So in the US region, that might be a little different, or it might lag a little bit behind. But in particular in Europe, I would say that's definitely the case, that vehicle sharing and that you do not own a car anymore is also becoming more and more common. And then, of course, we also need to consider that there will be serious infrastructure changes. So it's not just about individual transport. For now, I have only talked about electric vehicles and individual transport. But there is multi-billion dollar investments currently funded from governments, from countries, from all kind of different sources into railway, into high-speed trains, into revamping, into modernization projects. So that's also, of course, one thing that will grow significantly in the future. And the ambition is definitely to bring more people from the road, eliminate or reduce individual transport and try to make it attractive enough that people change, for example, to train and to bus or other things. And in particular, in more urban areas in cities, I also believe that cities will have to become smarter. So there could also be technologies to manage traffic flow, reduce congestions, and just, you know, overall improve the efficiency on how we get through the cities. At the moment, you know, this is there is rush hour. It's really a pain sometimes, and that's going to change. And I can already see it in major European cities. It's currently happening that roads are basically removed from city centers, and there is more room for pedestrians. Plants, that there is trees planted, and a lot of other things, just more space for pedestrians, for human to live and breathe, basically. So I think the quality of life in cities will also significantly be improved. And the reason, of course, why we're all doing this, I think the overarching topic here is a sustainability focus. We all know that the European Union is quite ambitious. There is a regulation in place that has a pretty strict emission regulations. And that also means that transportation in general will become much, much more green, and it will be more serious about CO2 emissions and those kind of things. So I think that's in a nutshell a few things that I can see midterm. Again, in 10 years, it could be different again, but I guess those are somehow the main points where we're heading at when I think about future mobility.
Yeah, thank you for giving this really broad overview. And I would like to ask you on one topic that you mentioned, because you mentioned also mobility providers. I mean, you said Lyft and Uber, etc. But would you see also that the classic OEMs could transition also themselves in kind of mobility providers, or they would have to? What's your opinion on that?
Again, I don't have the crystal ball, but for sure it would be an option. So there is different revenue streams from car OEMs as well. And in particular with subscription models, for example, I mean, today, if you buy a car, I mean, all the functions that you can use, like seat heating and stuff like this, is already available if you buy it and if you have bought it before. But in the future, it could be like that there is new revenue streams and new options. That, okay, in winter time, I would like to use the seat heating. So you buy a subscription model, or you opt in for that via a software platform. And then basically this function is enabled in your car. So those are things that will also come in the future, most likely directly deployed from car OEMs. Yes.
Actually, we will come to the topic of the future trends once again in our conversation. So let's go with the next question. And Ted, as demand for electric vehicles increases, like Christian only just a couple of minutes ago mentioned that. So how is Rockwell Automation ensuring that its supply chain of services meets the growing demands of the battery market? How do you do that?
Yeah, I can say going through the supply chain shortage right on the heels of the shutdowns related to COVID globally, it was probably the most difficult 2 years in my entire career, where we were helping factories shut down, stop. We all know what happened, and then subsequently start them up. But taking a global economy and basically halting everything that was happening and then bringing that back to the levels that we all expected quickly proved to be just phenomenally difficult. And then on top of that, the chip shortage, and of course, being a technology company, so much of our equipment depends on that. As I said, it was so painful because I don't think we had a customer out there that wasn't affected by it. And nothing is more difficult than making your customers unhappy. And we did that day in and day out. They wanted to make their products. They wanted to solve their potential customers' needs for their products. So we learned a lot from that. We had a very tight, just-in-time manufacturing process spread around the globe. And we had to take a very hard look at that. We changed our manufacturing model. We added capacity. We spent millions and millions of dollars globally to make certain that if something like this happened again, we could respond much more quickly. So it was a very difficult period, and a lot of hard lessons were learned. But with significant investments that we put in place, both with manufacturing capacity and with people, I think we're a much better company today as a result of that.
But even if this experience is painful for you and for your customers as well, but that's how you learn, how you get actually resilient in the future. No? So yeah, definitely. And now, Pierre, how is Rockwell Automation integrating advanced technologies such as industrial Internet of Things and artificial intelligence to optimize and enhance the efficiency of the EV battery supply chain?
That's a very far-reaching question. Thanks for asking it. So, you know, again, from my sales perspective, right, what I see, the first, the most important thing, whichever the customer is, right, whether we're talking about the EV or battery or any other kind of industry, right, the most important thing that Rockwell does in partnership with the customer is to establish what kind of outcomes the customer wants to impact in the future and what kind of strategies that we can help the customer accelerate, right? So that's the most important thing. Then after, when we're clear on this and when we're clear on how we get to engage the customer and integrate all these different solutions, we never start with the solution first. We have a programmatic approach that starts from planning into the design, into the integration. Finally, we are launching a solution and then we are optimizing it along the way. So this is kind of a continuous cycle, if you will, that helps us bring the most and the best of what Rockwell has to offer to the customer, meaning to say, in terms of IoT, and you're talking about industrial AI, right? Digital engineering, emulation techniques, network security, cybersecurity, manufacturing execution systems, predictive maintenance, prescriptive maintenance, all these capabilities and tools and software solutions that Rockwell has to offer, in addition to the regular automation platforms, intelligent conveyance systems, and also the vast breadth of our own capabilities together combined with also our partners' capabilities, right, to bring to bear for the customer. At the end of the day, when I see a project and an opportunity well orchestrated with a customer, integrating seamlessly all these different components, all these different parts of the digital thread, we eventually always somehow impact the following use cases and type of indicators for the customer. It may be a combination of increasing, let's say, the faster time to market, minimizing capital expenditures. It could be de-risking the complete project launch. It could be enhancing in the long term the production quality. It can be bringing agility, scalability, right? The whole connected enterprise, connected enterprise production system to the customer, and eventually also protecting their IP along the way. So I think this solution that we deploy is always starting from the customer in mind first, right? Trying to understand what they want to achieve and then partnering with them along the way to eventually find the technologies or the cocktail of technologies that they need in order to accelerate their particular outcomes that they have. And every customer is different, to be honest. Every customer has a different starting point, but that's the specificity of Rockwell to have this consultative approach at the beginning to make sure that we don't propose a technology up front, but we really understand where the customer is headed, right? Because eventually the combination of capabilities, technologies, solutions, and sometimes also partners involved in the realization of those solutions for the customer is unique.
You know, even if you come from sales, I deeply understand that your approach is first not to sell as quickly as possible, but to understand deeply the customer. Okay, what do they actually want? And with this approach, plan, design, optimizing, you spend maybe more time in the beginning, but in the end, you deliver a better solution for the customer. And also, I guess that you win also time afterwards. Let's say that it gets much, much faster and with a better understanding. No? Yeah, now let's bring Christian in this discussion because, Christian, we can really definitely say that global collaboration is one of your core topics. No? So, and with this EV market being global, how does Rockwell Automation collaborate with international partners to create a seamless and efficient global supply chain for EV batteries?
The first thing that comes into my mind is, of course, our global reach. So at Rockwell, we have, I think, one very big advantage. We are a multi-industry company. And that means that we not only focus on the automotive industry, on the battery industry, we also have relationships established with mining companies, with refining companies, with battery material suppliers, with even recycling companies. And I think that is definitely key to enable a proper cross-border collaboration amongst all the different parties that participate in this global battery value chain. And of course, if we work with customers and if we work with partners, then we will leverage those relationships to create a more seamless and more efficient communication across all the different parties here. So that's one thing that we can do as a global company. And then maybe the second point that comes into my mind, it's coming more from a technology point of view. So in order to create a more seamless supply chain, I think some kind of full end-to-end traceability would help a lot or could improve the situation a lot. I'm thinking about the digital battery passport here. I think by now most of the people have heard this term before and are somewhat familiar of what it is. If you're not so familiar, maybe let me just briefly explain what it is. It's kind of a digital twin or digital representation of the physical battery cell that stores all kind of very important and relevant information. For example, what materials exactly went into that cell, how much CO2 emissions were generated throughout the process to prove that there was no child labor involved in the mining process. Also to prove that there is a certain amount of recycled content in the battery cell used. Other things like what is the status and health of my battery? What is the expected lifetime and much more. So you can see this is really a powerful technology. In the past, Rockwell was more the expert on the manufacturing shop floor. So that means we, with our solutions, we can do traceability end to end on the manufacturing floor, but that's basically the plant boundaries. But thanks to our partnerships with different companies, we can now also enable manufacturers to participate in that electronic exchange system in this digital battery passport. So those are, I think, two things that we can contribute to a more efficient global supply chain. And the last topic that I think that comes into my mind is, of course, we work with international organizations also to establish some common standards. So you can imagine if you have not properly defined the interfaces between all those different parties, it's going to be very difficult to exchange information and a proper seamless flow of information. So that's also something where we contribute. We work with those international organizations to set the standards of tomorrow in terms of supply chain.
Yeah, we will definitely also come to that so that we learn also what is like, how do you do collaboration best or worst? No? So we will definitely tap into your wisdom there as well. So now let's go for the topic of sustainability. And yes, we can say sustainability is one of the key factors in the automotive industry, but we have to be honest and real there. Sometimes it is based on the core beliefs of a brand or of a company, but sometimes it's not. It's just simply based on regulations. No? So honest we can be, I guess. No? So, and Ted, what is the role of Rockwell Automation in it? And how are you addressing the environmental impact of the EV battery supply chain from raw material extraction to end-of-life recycling?
I think what we're seeing, what's happening globally with this massive change in the way we manage transportation is really once in a lifetime. Definitely most of us in our career will never experience anything like this, but the billions of dollars that are being spent to change something that we've done in a certain fashion for over 100 years. And the thing that excites me about that is obviously we want to do what's best for the environment. Everybody wants to make the world a better place, a cleaner place. That's the legacy we all hope and want to share and leave with our children. But at this point in time, technology that we have available is enhancing our ability to do this. You mentioned in your question, some companies do the right thing because it's a good policy. They want to be a good corporate citizen. Other governments mandate. Our hope is with a proper application of our technology, we're making it easy to build that into the factory from the beginning. And Christian hit on that. The mining companies are our customer, where we process the reactive chemicals and then finally build the battery cell and ultimately get back to the recycling process. We can help our customers see and share the vision of how to make all of that work together with sustainability in mind from the beginning. And it's really transformational to be able to do that with all of these green fields. I'll admit it's much harder to go in and rewire an existing factory to get the maximum benefits from that. And we most certainly do that each and every day. But with all of the new growth in the EV market and energy storage, we've got a unique opportunity, I think, in our history to do it right and to get it right.
Let's go a bit deeper in that direction. So let's stay with this environmental impact that you do day in, day out. So whenever I interview battery manufacturers directly and I bring up the subject of recycling, they always give me this comment, yeah, we have just this still low volume, so we cannot do that much. No? So at some point, however, it will suddenly become very topical. Pierre, could you give us an overview of how Rockwell Automation is currently involved in the end-of-life recycling and what the future of scaling looks like?
Yeah, I absolutely. I think the first thing that I would like to convey here is that Rockwell, as a manufacturer, right, we take this very seriously. It's not just a matter of compliance. It's a matter of helping our customers, right, with their own emissions, with their own greenhouse gas footprint and so on, and with their own recycling capability. So I think we are taken very seriously by also by our customers because we are ourselves a manufacturer. And when I look first at what we do and what we've been pioneering in the area of recycling, I think it's very important before we can get an understanding of how we can scale that, right, with our customers. We have in our facility already an 88% recycling rate, right? And I will come to that, right? It's really one of the core pillars of our Scope 1 emissions. So we pay a lot of attention since many years in understanding our baseline, in understanding our actions to reduce our emissions in the different scope 1, 2, and 3. And in the recycling area, and we'll come back to that in a minute, we are already at 88% recycling rate. In 2024, we're actually bringing this rate to another level to 90%. And quite honestly, what we do with this is we avoid waste to be diverted to landfills. This is what we do, right, at the end of the day. So we maximize the reusability of components, of materials, or even sometimes chemical materials, right, to be able to bring them and give them a new life, a new lease on life in a prolongation of the life expectancy of the product. So how do we do this? We have at Rockwell this industrial automation repair services, which are really rooted in our ability to remanufacture and repair products end-of-life products that are coming from installations that the customer has in their plants and their machines, right? So the customer is basically is able to establish with us and with our services and our capabilities a kind of a roadmap that is based on a fix-it-first approach, if you will, that is not based on renew everything and again have a tremendous impact on the environment, but be able to either make this part of the product or the entire product reusable again for another 10, 15, 20 years, right? Depending on the product. So I think these industrial automation repair services is an industrial recovery process that is deeply rooted in our, which we use in our own facilities, if you will, and that we are bringing to bear for our customers. What we came up with actually 2 years ago is we have we pioneered a very innovative approach in the area of recycling by creating around this capability of repair and remanufacturing a kind of calculator for the customer. So they're able, with our service engineers, to be able to prove to their own finance teams and C-level officers of their company what is the return on investment of repairing, of remanufacturing, of recycling in general, the products of Rockwell. And so we help them, not only by our services, but also we're using this calculator that was awarded in 2022 at the global level, and that was referred to in a white paper at the recent World Economic Forum in Davos. So by having mentioned this, I hope that I was able to give you a little bit of a better understanding of our capabilities to help our customers along the journey to recycle and reuse, basically. And I would like to close this because you asked me about scaling. So scaling is always, you know, how you bring this to the market and how you become, how you get it kind of give it an industrial approach, right, towards the market. And I found this example in Ontario, in North America, very, very inspirational, because we're talking about electrical vehicles and batteries. This is a kind of an integrated electrical vehicles and battery park. And that company that we're helping is called Electra. And they are mentioned actually in our sustainability report, right, which is publicly available. We help that company refine and reuse chemical components that are used in those electrical batteries, right? And we're talking about nickel, we're talking about cobalt, we're talking about manganese, and the ability, thanks to Rockwell Technologies, to be able to refine and reuse in new batteries and give them a second lease on life, right, is dramatically enhancing the ability, first of all, the GHG, so the greenhouse gas footprint, and also ultimately the recycling capability of our customers using Rockwell technology. So here we are in the heart of the EV and battery sector, and we're acting for the ability of that sector to become more green and recycle more than ever before, thanks to Rockwell technologies. And we're going to bring these capabilities and experience as a manufacturer and based on these kind of, let's say, success stories to other parts of the EV battery industry.
Actually, you not only gave the technical overview in your reply, but you also gave me the strategy, actually, not just me, but also to our listeners, let's say, who that can be very relevant to, because the strategy is actually to talk their language, right? So if you talk in numbers, in, let's say, what you can win from that, then everyone understands. So if that's really financial winning behind that, so then end-of-life recycling can be very, very attractive suddenly.
Absolutely. It's a business opportunity. It's not only just an environmental mandate, but it's a business opportunity.
Now, let's stay with the focus on sustainability also for Christian's question. So you're always on the lookout for suitable new technologies and new partners. And I'm interested in what criteria do you use to decide whether a company would be a great potential partner or whether a technology is relevant for Rockwell. So to what extent does sustainability really play a role there? If at all, maybe not. So surprise me.
Sure. So before we even think about new partnerships or adding new technologies, we need to have a look whether there is a customer need that Rockwell cannot fulfill with our own portfolio, at least at the moment. Then we might also have a look at our roadmap just to see if we maybe have planned something in the future to develop in-house, or maybe we even want to buy something in the near future. If that is all a no, then we might look out for potential partners. And then, of course, a couple of criteria would be, what is the size of that company? Are they already large enough? Do they have some proven technology? And perhaps the most important criteria is, do they already have some paying customers? Because if they do have some paying customers, that means for us that the market has already done some due diligence and found them worthy, if you want to say. The next thing that we might look at is whether a software annual recurring revenue model is possible and whether it's even scalable. That's extremely important as well. And another important thing is everything that we do in terms of a new partner, in terms of a new technology, it also needs to align and fit with our own strategy and business objectives. And I think Pierre elaborated that in quite a lot of details. So in general, if we look at our own strategy and business objectives, of course, sustainability plays a very big role here. So that also means that whoever we partner with also needs to fit into that mindset, into that sustainability mindset. And in addition to that, I think it's also extremely important for us in terms of our strategy and business objectives that the cultural fit with a potential partner is also given. So that means that they are same as we, committed to integrity, diversity, inclusion, those kind of things. And then last but not least, I think it's extremely important that we also have some kind of executive engagement. So once they have matched all those criterias, once there is a go, then it's the right time to engage one of our senior vice presidents and also from the partner side, the right executives that sponsor this relationship and this partnership, because I think that's key for success if you really want to partner at this level. So that's in a nutshell.
Thank you very much for making me still believe in the good in the world, because I think that's very important to see that it's not just about financial benefits, but it's also about sustainability and, as you mentioned, also equality, diversity, inclusion, etc., etc. So all very, very important topics. So now we stay in the topic of collaboration. And Ted, now and again, it goes beyond collaboration, and Rockwell Automation also acquires companies. No? So what aspects are involved in making such decision to acquire or just to collaborate?
Yeah, I think Christian did a great job outlining the criteria that we use to bring in these companies that may enhance our portfolio, whether that be hardware or software. Something I've experienced, let's just say in the past 10 years, that is quite new and quite unique is acquiring companies for the people. And it's been disruptive. And I'm talking about artificial intelligence, machine learning. So this is a disruptive technology that's swept across manufacturing globally, incredibly difficult to build a strong base of that internally quickly. So I've seen Rockwell make some really astute decisions and gone out and looked at some of the strongest players. And basically, we're partnering with people who understand this. A different MO for Rockwell, a lot of electrical engineers in our company, mechanical, computer scientists. Now we're flooded with data scientists and people with a different viewpoint, a different skill set. And it's enhanced our ability to solve our customers' problems in ways a few years ago no one was even considering. So it's really been exciting to see as we've evolved and the partnerships that have come as a result of that.
So you would also here say that the human factor is super, super crucial in deciding, basically.
Absolutely, yeah.
So now let's put the acquisitions aside and look again only on potential collaborations and partnerships. So Pierre and Christian, I have a question for both of you, but I will divide that so that everyone can answer his part. So what companies' profiles are you currently looking for to form strategic partnerships? So Pierre, could you please focus on established companies and Christian only on startups? So then we have this division.
Yeah, established players. So, generally what I see is, and I would refer to the transformation that I was referring to before. right? The transformation towards being a lifelong partner of our customers in the area of productivity and sustainability. And the first thing that I would like to say, right, before even talking about what drives our partnership, what drives our alliances strategy, is that productivity and sustainability is actually one. The sustainability topic for Rockwell is a connected topic. It's a topic of integration and connectivity. So productivity and sustainability actually are forming one on the back of a common software platform that are providing productivity and sustainability benefits to our customers. So it's not just one or the other. It is one and the same topic, right? And very often when you, as Rockwell, want to be on the cutting edge, right, in bringing sustainability solutions to our customers, what we realize talking to those customers is that it's not just a technology discussion. The executive conversation that takes place with the customer is revolving around a business model. I think that Ted and Christian were alluding to that before. It's creating a service model. It's creating a stream of annual recurring revenue over the life cycle of the equipment that the customer places on the plant floor, which did not exist before. So not only is software important for Rockwell, for our own manufacturing sites, for our own financial solutions and financial situation regarding, you know, how well we are regarded also by the financial community, but it's also important for our customers, let's say machine builders, for instance. Machine builders, when they build a machine, they sell the machine at a single digit percentage of margin. And what they want to do is increase the stream of annual recurring revenues and services over the life cycle of the machine. And why is that important to this question? Is because when we want to convert a customer to sustainability, productivity solutions based on software, a customer like a machine builder wants to have an executive discussion with us on the business model. And this business model is much more encompassing and large discussion than just purely a technology. The customer needs to understand what they put themselves into when they adopt this kind of technology, right? And how they're going to be able to monetize this technology with the rest of their value chain, with the rest of their customers. So what kind of partnership and strategy alliances this drives? It drives, in my view, the kind of, you know, like the appetite for Rockwell to partner and form strategic alliances with companies that have professional services in the industrial AI space. Because once again, not everyone has all technology bricks, and it's more about the ability to consultatively sell, diagnose a customer, sell to a customer what they're going to need to create this lifelong, you know, life cycle approach, right? To annual recurring revenues. And the ability to do this is only provided by very strong consultative industry expertise and consultative approach to the customer. And Ted was talking about data scientists. We also have a growing number of industry consultants. And these industry consultants are coming to us from previous acquisitions, right? So it's not just acquisitions, you're right. It's also in alliances and partnerships. But the step before acquiring a company in the area of professional services is a partnership with a company that does a little bit of what we do, but can enhance geographically our ability to touch this and this particular market, right? And I'm talking about global IT system integrators, right? We're talking about Accenture. We're talking about Actemium, for example, in Central Europe. But we're also talking about regional IT system integrators, right? And I would like to say just one thing again in the area of acquisition, but it's the same would hold true for partnerships. When we acquired Calypso a few years ago, or when we acquired Knowledge Lens recently in India, the same kind of partnership drive are driven by the same, let's say, intent and the same strategic objective of making us stronger in front of various industries, in our ability to orchestrate consultative selling, in order to orchestrate the whole new business model that the customer will adopt, right, when they will take software solutions on board to drive productivity and sustainability for themselves and for their customers. So the ability to partner more with these kind of companies that have professional services in the industrial AI space is absolutely crucial.
You gave now me so many details so that I will definitely have some follow-up questions on that. But now I'm curious to see how is that similar or different from the Christian point of view for exactly startups, if we really talk about different sizes of the company, if that matters at all.
For sure, there is a lot of similarities, what Pierre just mentioned with startups, but maybe let me frame this a little bit within my responsibility and within the battery industry again. So what company profiles we would typically look at when we look at startup partnerships. So I would say everything from downstream in the battery value chain. So that means companies active in battery material supply, battery makers, of course, companies that provide battery systems, battery integration, and even further to recycling. I mean, obviously the risk with partnering with a startup is much higher, but at Rockwell, I can definitely say that we are more than willing to pre-invest and collaborate if there is, number one, a sound business case behind with a unique product and market approach. I think that's really important for us. And then for a startup, we would also look at different things like, is there sufficient funding behind? Do they have some realistic goals and timelines? I also mentioned before the importance of an existing customer base and whether the market has already done some due diligence. What are their focus markets and applications? Does that fit with our focus markets and where we actually want to go? So those are some of the key criteria that I would look at the startup company. And then same as before, as I mentioned, aligning with our integrated business objectives and also whether they are really serious about sustainability. You heard it a couple of times also from Pierre now that we are really ambitious in achieving net zero, that we have set ourselves very high targets. And we also expect the same from our, let's say, future partners, no matter whether they're already an established global player or whether they're a startup company. So that's, I would say, the big similar thing that I see here from what Pierre just described before.
And also, as I remember from our briefing, you said also you stay sometimes for years and years with some startups in contact until you really do business with them. And that is also part of the, let's say, more the consulting approach that was already mentioned by Pierre several times. So like, really, first of all, understanding where they are and what they actually want, what they need, and then starting to collaborate as soon as you understood that. So, yeah. Now let's talk also about something that Pierre already mentioned before, but let me give that question to Ted. So in May 2020, Rockwell Automation acquired Kalypso, as Pierre mentioned just before. And Kalypso is based in US. It's a software delivery and consulting firm specializing in the digital evolution of industrial companies with a strong client base in life science, in consumer products, in industrial high tech, et cetera, et cetera. So could you tell us how the last 4 years turned out to be?
Yeah, Kalypso. What an incredible company and a enhancement to Rockwell's portfolio. In 4 short years, I've watched leadership from Kalypso move into the highest positions in our company. Thought leaders, they have really changed the way we look at everything, and that has brought so many more potential solutions to our customers. Obviously, we make products, motion and drives and everything our customers need to be successful in their manufacturing process. With Kalypso, they've helped show us how we can build that intelligence into the base product. Now you have a sensor or a drive where before it was enough to operate a fan or a pump. Now with the artificial intelligence that we can add to that drive platform, we can tell the operator the health of that pump or the longevity or help them schedule service intervals. The power that has come from that acquisition has just been phenomenal. And I think we're just really scratching the surface for what we're going to be able to do with this company. And then we take it to the other side where it's customer focused. And I've had so many interesting calls with the Calypso team when I visit a customer. And we spoke about this earlier. We listen, they talk about their problems, we think, and then our job is to help solve those problems. The Calypso team sees their capability with their software platform and the people that they can really enhance any and most aspects of manufacturing. So what that's opened up for us is make really the problems that we can solve nearly unlimited. So incredibly exciting, and what a great group of people that company had put together. So it's been a great experience, and I think we're only now seeing the potential of what's going to come from that.
Actually, when the acquisition happened, it was really like in the middle of the pandemic. Was it somehow a slowdown, or did it give you even the time to get to know each other and then start full force, let's say, to go after customers?
You're exactly right. It gave us the chance to integrate and get to know the people and do more internal training. This is who we are. This is what we do. This is how we go to market. So I think the Rockwell team was much more prepared than when we could get back out and start talking to our customers to have the meaningful conversations. So it's a really great point, and that's exactly how that played out.
All the best for the next years. We will come together again, and I will ask the next question, let's say, about the last 4 years. No? So 4 years in advance. No? So Pia, now we stay in the topic of collaboration. We just sharpen our focus to only automotive manufacturers. So how closely does Rockwell Automation collaborate with automotive manufacturers to tailor its automation solutions to specific requirements and ensure seamless integration into the overall vehicle manufacturing process? So now really let's look only at OEMs.
Well, again, I would start from, you know, the customer reality today, right? And I think it was very well outlined by Ted, right, a minute ago. The ability of Rockwell to understand the current reality of our customers, right, is absolutely, I mean, second to none right now. In bringing this consultative and, you know, and industry experience in the heart of the EV and battery industry, right, I think for me is absolutely second to none. The second comment that I would like to bring to your question is, we see a lot of challenges, right, on the EV and battery customers, right? And they have increasingly complex value chains. They have, I would say, 3 to 4 typical daunting challenges, right, ahead of them. One is speed to market, right? I think I mentioned that before at a, let's say, more general level. Growing competition between mature car makers, right, and startups to meet the electrical vehicles demand from the market, supported by battery manufacturers, is really leading to a concept of, you know, earning share, you know, early, and be able to position new models and new technologies early in the market and get that new early like earlier entrant advantage, if that makes sense. I think the second thing that I see, right, Ludmila, is that there is evolving battery technology, right? So when we're looking at EV batteries, there is a level of customization, right, that's driving the need for flexibility in the manufacturing arena, operations, and alternative materials also for lightweighting, that when we take into account, you know, what kind of automation solutions that demands down the road is also a very important criteria for us to take into account. The third thing that I see is probably true in every industry that I'm facing in my region is workforce enablement, right? We see a lot of labor shortages, talent scarcity on the market, and suppliers need, of course, more assistance than ever before in developing smart manufacturing standards to drive digital value. And also due to the gap also in supplier workforce as well, right? Finally, I would say an optimized launch and production, right? So manufacturers are looking to increase operational efficiency to improve quality and decrease scrap rates. So the whole concept of bringing artificial intelligence in the processes of our customer to be able to eliminate as much possible waste, variability in quality rates and churn rates, to be able to eventually then improve both throughput and quality. So this has very deep and very profound business implications. So when you're looking at the speed to market, the evolving technologies around batteries, the workforce enablement, and the optimized production requirements of our customer. Rockwell, through the additional sort of Calypso in our portfolio 2-3 years ago, is able to bring a lot of digital technologies to bring to bear on those different use cases, if you will, right? We talked about that before. It's digital twins. I think Christian talked about that. There is also, but it's not just purely digital. It's a mix of project management around the different OEMs and different machine builders, right? Coordinated around one project, right? And the different, in kind of a contractor approach, right? Around a particular project. So there is a digital around, for example, digital twins, cybersecurity, ICT, so independent cart technology, the ability also to bring more of optimization in the maintenance space around CMMS, around augmented reality, right, for workforce enablement. But also, as I said, the ability to enforce specifications across the vast network of machine builders. And all of this also around the optimized launch and production through our ability to put in place manufacturing execution systems, quality management systems, production planning, and consulting systems that at the end of the day bring the value that is demanded by our customers in face of those four major challenges. So again, if I sum up all the years that I've been working for this company, I see a tremendous ability now of Rockwell to understand, orchestrate digital solutions, but not digital just for the sake of productivity, but also for the sake of sustainability, cybersecurity. We haven't talked about that too much. And to be able to orchestrate the fewer resources that every customer has now at their disposal, given the market situation, and make the interface between people, and I'll probably come back to that hopefully in the remainder of this sequence. But I would say putting the people at the heart and not the technology first, right? So that at the end, because there's few of people available, is make technology friendly, familiar, right, to the operators. So that's this interface between the technology and the operator on the plant floor or in front of a particular machine is the most effective, the most sustainable, and the most safe and secure one for the benefit of our customer.
We will now continue first with the collaboration topic, but then we will come back and talk about the human factor, and we will also touch a little bit of cybersecurity topic because it's just currently too important not to talk about. No? So thank you very much, Pierre, for this very, very broad reply. Liked it so much, and you gave me again plenty of details to talk further in that panel. So Christian, you are kind of an, let's say, collaboration expert in Rockwell Automation. So, and you saw, I guess, a lot of very successful collaborations, but I think honestly that you also saw some of them failing. So what would be the core ingredients of a successful collaboration? So, and does the size of a company matter there? Is that the difference?
Mm-hmm. So for me, I think it all starts with setting clear objectives and also properly aligning with each other. So it really starts with having a clear understanding. Why are you even collaborating with each other? Sometimes that's not clear, believe me. And you should really know what is the common objectives and what is also the expected outcome of a collaboration. I think that's the very first thing that should be clarified. When I talk about alignment, thinking about, again, the core values of each party. So at Rockwell, we are very serious. You heard it again about sustainability, but also work ethics. And if you team up, you need to make sure that the teams are also compatible with each other. I think those are pretty important topics. Another one that is sometimes not so clear is, you know, having really some roles and responsibilities defined. So that can already avoid a lot of confusion and overlap. And I think it's also important to make sure that each party knows who is accountable for what. Along with that, I think setting up some proper and efficient communication channels is also very important, so that you really maintain and have some regular exchange of information, that you do regular updates, that you also do feedback rounds, etc., to further improve also the flow of communication, of information across that. another point I think that is quite often overlooked, it's quite obvious again, is if you collaborate with somebody, there should also be a mutual benefit. But I have seen many examples where there is, you know, a collaboration and only one party basically benefits or gets something out of it. If you partner with Rockwell, for example, we always make sure that you get access to our markets, to our customers, to our technology, to our expertise, and really help you to also save costs, etc. So that's the advantage of partnering with Rockwell for sure. And I think also if we partner with somebody, we also expect that they do the same, right? And at the end of the day, so once you have set up some kind of collaboration, I think you need to further build on that relationship, and you really need to make sure that the key stakeholders from each party spend enough time working with each other to build, you know, and foster that clear relationship here. So that's, I would say, in a nutshell, where I would see a successful recipe for collaboration. In terms of company size, I think there is pros and cons that come with a larger company or with a smaller company. So if take Rockwell, for example, as a large company, I think the big advantage that we have almost an abundance of resources. So we have really a lot of different people in all different regions globally. We have a lot of expertise, not only in battery and automotive, but also in many other industries that we can share and utilize. But on the other hand, I think the disadvantage sometimes with large companies is that larger companies in general, I think, are not that agile, like compared to a startup or to a smaller company. Sometimes decision-making, bureaucracy and things like this take a little longer. And if we look at smaller companies, the advantages obviously are they are much more agile, quicker in terms of decision-making. I would also say, in particular, if I look at battery, that most of those companies are very much driven by innovation, or they come out of innovation. They come out of universities, of academia. So I think they're highly innovative. I'm not saying that big companies, large companies are not innovative, but in particular startups, I believe this is one of the very big advantages. But the disadvantage with a smaller company, of course, is they are lacking resources, they're lacking expertise. And this is where I see that both companies, a large and a small company, can actually complement each other, right?
You know what is really interesting, because when you mention all the factors, all the ingredients that play a role, it's also very clear that it's usually not because of the technical issues or technical challenges that collaboration don't work. It's usually because of communication, again, human factor. Do people clearly align even on the goals, right? I mean, you said like it should be obvious, but it's not. No? So that's pretty interesting.
That's the bread and butter. It's still people dealing with people, right? That's the most important thing. But it's also a lot of points that are very simple things actually to consider. But if you don't do it, then that could definitely harm a successful collaboration.
Interesting that we started even with that. Now we started already with the human factor, actually. Yeah, so that makes really sense, no? Yeah. I will actually mention later on why I did that, the unusual introduction. So, but we will come to that. So let's get a little bit technical now. So Ted, as the automotive industry becomes increasingly digitalized, what cybersecurity measures does Rockwell Automation employ to safeguard the integrity, but also the security of the EV battery supply chain? So now we finally come to the cybersecurity topic.
I think we all wish this was a topic we didn't have to address, but it's an unfortunate reality that there are bad actors, both external and internal, that wish to create harm for a variety of reasons.
Please explain the internal, because I don't get it. What do you mean by eternal dark characters?
I can tell you, we see where a disgruntled employee who has free access to come into a factory and connect to the computer systems and can do tremendous damage. We've also seen where an engineer from maybe a system integrator or an OEM may have picked up a virus in his hotel room while he's watching movies, and then he goes to a customer and hooks to their network, and that virus propagates, and it's internal, not deliberate. So it's a messy world out there when it comes to digital hygiene. We have thousands of customers, and everything from the small mom and pop to the global enterprise. So the needs and the tools necessary to solve the cybersecurity problem across that spectrum is incredibly complex. So in addition to what we've developed internally and partnerships and acquisitions, we have a really extensive portfolio that helps our customers. It's certainly not one size fits all. And it's a lot of work to understand the risks. And the other thing that people don't think about is it isn't just a hardware or a software solution. A big piece of this is people and processes.
Scary.
What's allowed, what's not allowed, how people operate within the factory. So it's a really comprehensive, complicated topic. And Rockwell has an incredible team that's working on that full time for our customers because the consequences are significant.
Can I spontaneously ask you about some numbers? Let's say if we compare the last year to the pre-last year, so did the, let's say, dark cases doubled or something? Or is there any kind of percentage or trend what you see?
I would have a hard time giving you any numbers with accuracy, but I can tell you in the dozens of customers that I'm working with each week and month that the cases are continually going up. Continually. Yes.
I have some numbers about the automotive industry only. So because the cybersecurity report from Upstream Security was just published recently, and they said like, okay, to the previous year, it really doubled. Yeah, so
I'm not surprised.
And 90%, yeah, not surprised. And actually 90% are done actually remotely completely. Yeah, so you don't need to be even physically there to cause some damage.
You're absolutely right. We all know the stories where it makes the news and the devastation that happens to a company, whether it's with ransomware or potentially shutting down critical infrastructure in power generation or water, wastewater, the things we all seem to take for granted. But what people don't know and what we see is when we talk to our customers and look at the tools we have in place, and there are literally thousands of attempts throughout a week of others, bad actors, trying to penetrate these firewalls to do something unsavory. It is incredible the number that goes on out there. But yeah, this is a very important topic.
But good to know that you have your people working on that and taking that seriously. So now we heard a little bit of, or a lot of dangers, but I'm a very optimistic person. So usually on 99% of the days. So Pia, I need your support in that. So let's talk a little bit about opportunities. So which new markets or new topics or new project excite you currently the most where you look ahead, let's say 10 to 15 years? So yeah. Give me something inspirational.
Yeah, you know, before working with Rockwell Automation, I was working for a French company called Schneider Electric, you know, and that gave me the passion of machine builders. So we at Rockwell serve extensively the machine builder segment. And here we've been talking mostly about electrical vehicles and battery end users, right? So which are the customers that are buying machines and then eventually over the life cycle of the machine are destroying the machine. So my passion is to make sure that one day, instead of just following the end user in their and accompanying the end users in their digital journey, that we're able to embark also the rest of the ecosystem. I'm coming back to my passion for machine builders. The machine builders today are left primarily, they feel really left alone. And the ability to bring the benefits of software solutions to their end user. They need a partner like Rockwell, and I think Rockwell is probably the best positioned in the industry, right? Owing to our very long heritage on automation, our knowledge of OT and IT networks, and our ability to bridge both, right? And to bring to bear to the OEM, because this, when we call it OEM in our jargon, is, let's say, more of a machine builder, right? To bring to a tier, an industry tier player, supplier in the automotive industry, just making sure that it's not just the existing machines on the plant floors that are cyber secure, that are sustainable, that are productive, that meet the quality standards and so on, but that's also the influx of new machines coming into the plant floor. And that to me is, I can say it's my passion, right? And I employ a lot of my time. If I have any spare hour of my time, I employ it to make sure that my machine builder customers know how to use and also co-sell with us to the end customer the benefit of having a machine equipped with Rockwell automation, hardware and software solutions on board of the server of the machine, for example, right? Just to make sure that there is a continuity of business in what we do on the plant floor and also on the oncoming waves of new machines coming into the plant floor in the months and years to come, right? And the ability to bridge both. And I can tell you, this is not commonplace today, right? When we go to industrial fairs in our market, we increasingly see a lot of, focus and attention brought by the industry, our competitors and ourselves on the plant floors of our customers. But there is little, if no, successful attention and success stories also brought to the machine builder. And the machine builders are left a little bit to themselves to figure out, hey, what's in the digital future for us? How can we build more business with digital? How can we make our machines more autonomous? We've been talking maybe about autonomous manufacturing, right? So how do we help our customers to bring more of an autonomous operation, right, in their site? And I think that the biggest part of the market for us to address is not just the end users, but the end users surrounded by the machine builders that are serving those end users, right? And there is currently very little focus in the industry, but it's the most fascinating part, I guess, to see a German or Italian or Swiss machine builders or Austrian machine builders or British or French and so on bring with Rockwell Automation the right pitch, the right value to the end user, and making this end user more immune, right, on productivity problems, against sustainability problems, right, or cybersecurity problems that would occur if there was a lack of support to the machine builders. Because again, machine builders bring a lot of machines every year to plant floors, but not always to the same standard due to the level of attention that is brought, right, to the plant floors versus to new machines. So that's my passion.
Actually, I have to add that to our audience because they cannot see it, but I see that in the video. When you talk, it's your passion. It's visible, you know, your eyes just light up. I have never seen talking anyone so passionately about machine builders, you know, never, ever. I think it's also never going to happen in the future, but it's so visible. And I mean, that also explains why Rockwell Automation actually focuses on the whole ecosystem around that. It's not just about the end customers. It's also on everything that happens in between. No? So thank you for sharing your passion. It's amazing when people have this positive energy about that. So yeah, that leverage, let's say, or that balanced out the dangers of the cybersecurity and all the dark characters internally, externally. So yeah, that helps. So let's go further with the future trends. Christian, now considering the whole dynamic nature of the automotive industry that we just talked about, so how does Rockwell Automation stay adaptable to these kind of emerging trends and technologies in the EV battery supply chain and, yeah, actually ensuring the long-term relevance and competitiveness?
Mm-hmm. So same as every other bigger company in the market, we are, of course, continuously monitoring industry trends. We are conducting market research, we study industry reports and publications, we participate or we write industry publications, we of course attend conferences, we participate in forums just to gather more insights, right? We do have a global strategy industry marketing team in place that does all of that. So this is more or less the, let's say, standard approach on staying on top of all those dynamic changes in the industry. Then, as we already talked about today, we invest a lot of time in strategic partnerships and collaboration. You know, if you do it right, it's a mutual benefit. And one of those mutual benefits could be to also stay on top of those emerging new trends. In addition to that, we also invest quite a lot in research and development that could be either done in-house in one of our facilities, but we also have a strong interest and do a lot with academia, with universities in different regions, US, Europe, and also in Asia. Then in addition to that, I think key for us is also to have some kind of global cross-functional teams that collaborate with each other and share information. So that means we have subject matter experts in Asia, in Europe, and also in the US. And we frequently and regularly share information with each other. And that helps a lot to understand, as Pierre also mentioned, the entire ecosystem, not just your corridor, your region, right? So this is also something which is a good indicator for us. And then last but not least, I think the one of the most valuable feedback that you can get is if you talk to a customer, if you talk to a good partner. So this is where you can get a lot of information on what is really demanded at the market, what is coming up, whether there is some customization, some personalization necessary. I think that's, in my opinion, almost the most important thing here, to get this customer feedback.
Now let's mention slightly the topic that we had like a red line also through all the questions, always the human factor, et cetera, et cetera. So we have this kind of rapid advancement in technology. So how is Rockwell Automation addressing the need for skilled professionals in the field of industrial automation within the context of EV battery production? So, and I would love really to address this question to all of you. So which approach do you personally find most successful? And then again, let's start with Ted.
Yeah, I can quickly summarize something I'm working on today. And this is really prevalent to what's going on with the battery factories that are popping up all over the country. And it's a big concern for these manufacturers to get a skilled workforce. So we're in the process of partnering with universities. One in particular is a great example. They've actually got a battery manufacturing line at the university. The students, of course, can take advantage of that. Companies are able to hire time on the machinery to do testing, R&D, if you will, on this equipment. So that certainly helps the students at that particular campus, but utilizing tools, AR, VR, we're able through filming and building training sessions then to extend that learning capability to campuses across multiple states. So it's no longer necessary that you travel and stand in front of that machine, but you can actually be hundreds or a thousand miles away and still experience and go through the process of learning how to use, understand, maintain, or even troubleshoot this machine. And that's been a very powerful tool for our customers.
Do you have also some funded professorships then at those universities? Do you do also these kind of things?
You know, we don't do that. But as you would imagine, most of the universities are investing heavily in that space. We come in and partner with them when they actually are taking that knowledge and applying it to the machine. So whether it's on the chemistry side or the manufacturing side, formation testing, every aspect of it, we're really part of that manufacturing process of the ideas that are coming out of the universities and manufacturing.
I understand, yeah. So now, Pierre, you take on that?
Yeah, it's funny that Ted said that because it's. I wanted to use the same example, but maybe make it a little bit more, let's say, European, right? But in essence, it's the same thing. You know, when we want to hire or attract new talent at Rockwell, we realize that the dynamics of the market, of the labor market, have dramatically changed in the last 10 odd years. And that you see people in front of you whose primary decision criterion is to work for a company that makes a difference for the world, for the environment, for sustainability in general, right? So it's really how we get across the message of, you know, what Rockwell does for sustainability in the world, right? Especially in the industrial manufacturing. And the best possible way that we do this is to form the same partnerships that Ted has just alluded to in North America. And we do the same, right, in the heart of Europe, in Germany, around two tracks. And one is around cybersecurity, and the other one is around sustainability and digitalization. And many universities in Germany have approached us because they see us as deeply rooted, you know, right? So we have one leg in the industrial operations and the other in software and cyber. And even I would say Rockwell calls Rockwell an IT stock right now, if you will. So, but people in the university, the new talent of tomorrow, don't necessarily know this. And in the heart of Europe, where we have a more challenging, more competitive situation with local competitors, right, like Siemens and the other German and the competitors and Schneider Electric, what we see is the ability to differentiate ourselves is to portray ourselves like a champion of sustainability and cybersecurity. And the best way to get that done is to work with targeted universities in Europe around creating tracks for students, because it's exactly what the universities are asking us to do, right? And by doing so, we're step by step seeing some very interesting developments in targeted universities in Europe, especially around cyber, and people starting to understand, oh, but Rockwell is one of the main actors in that area, right? And the same for sustainability. And I think this is really, yeah, the way I'm deeply convinced that this is the main way to attract new people, talent, fresh talent in the company, especially in countries like in the heart of Europe that are based on this vocational training, right? The vocational training is absolutely crucial in countries like, I would say, most of the Nordics, the German-speaking countries, and now it's extending to also Eastern Europe, whereby students make, in kind of a partnership between industry and university, they do kind of a combined track, if you will, right? Going from one group of 4 to 6 weeks in industry on one particular project, and then coming back into the industry and sometimes also going to a system integrator and so on. And by having those new tracks around cyber and sustainability, we allow companies like machine builders, system integrators to also participate in those projects on those topics, and attract maybe, hopefully, the talent of tomorrow to Rockwell.
Actually, because you mentioned a similar example like Ted already did, it shows actually how successful it is. No? So because I asked you about your personal opinion, so it really that kind of indicator that it is successful. No?
And I believe, right, Ted lives in a part of the world where we have a dominant market share. I live and work for Rockwell and Information in a totally different area, which is Germany. And in Germany, we have a big challenger, right? Or set of very big challengers in front of us. And the best way to differentiate ourselves, not only towards the market, right, our customers, our partners, but also towards future talent working for Rockwell, is to position Rockwell as a champion, which we are, right, in the areas of sustainability and cybersecurity. And we've got a lot to bring to the new generations of tomorrow.
Actually, you know, don't be so hard on yourself, because one of your main competitors comes from Germany, so we know that. So that's just the truth, right? So, okay, now to Christian. So what's your take on that?
Well, I would like to take a slightly different approach here, more from a customer's point of view here. And perhaps it's even a little bit provocative. The question is, do we even need that many skilled professionals in the future? Because in my opinion, you need less skilled labor if you build in more automation in your operations, right? And this is exactly what we do. So we leverage our technology. So I think in the future, from a customer's point of view, again, we are moving more from, instead of the operator guiding the equipment, it will be the equipment that is guiding the operator. So also very inexperienced people will then be able to basically control and operate very complex machinery and equipment. And as Ted mentioned, there is already multiple different solutions available, such as, you know, using augmented reality for maintenance and operations equipment. You can also use remote services. For example, it's no longer necessary to have all experts in one region, in one country, in one plant. You could, for example, have your subject matter expert that knows the machine in and out sitting somewhere in Asia. He hooks up remotely and then guides basically the person on site that is facing the challenge with some augmented reality headset to troubleshoot the machinery. I mean, don't get me wrong, we will still need, I think, very skilled operators and technicians to support all the new technology. And of course, that will also mean that they will take on more fulfilling, higher value, higher paying roles. That's also clear. And we can, of course, also do a lot for those people to upskill with all kind of different standard services that we offer, starting from automation training services. We have customers training modules online and in facilities. You can also attend one of our events, no matter whether it's a Rock. Just last week, there was Rock 100, if you're familiar with that one. It's a event for the technical community where you can really get this hands-on experience, or automation fair, or annual conference and trade show. So those are things that we do in addition to that. But again, I think in the future, the goal is really to further simplify, further automate certain operations to, yeah, actually eliminate as much error sources as possible. And that also means that you need less skilled labor in the future.
Actually, very interesting approach. And also maybe it's just like a middle solution. And in the end, it will be even more AI operated, etc., so that we need less and less people or differently skilled people. No? So, but we will see. So again and again, we will need to come up again and decide and analyze the past and talk about the future. So now to conclude our episode, I would like to ask a few additional questions about your personal growth as individuals, but also as leaders, about your self-development and about leadership. So our listeners always appreciate valuable personal insights shared by our guests. So how did you come to where you are today? No, kind of. So Ted, you mentioned in our one-on-one briefing that you don't like to lose. And yet, mistakes and defeats are part of the natural process of maturity, of inner growth, for all of us, actually. So what are your own methods for dealing constructively and efficiently with defeats and mistakes? And please guide me through this process step by step. So how to handle that best?
Yeah, it's true. I am a very competitive person, and that's true in my personal life, my professional life, and even trying to solve my customers' problems. I want to get it right the first time, and I want it to be the best that it can possibly be. I reflect on that question and remember as a younger man, I spent considerable time trying to salvage a bad idea or a bad solution. And that in and of itself is a lesson. It's best to fail fast. And I've learned that. It's humbled me. And I see something going the wrong direction or find a better way coming from the team that you're working with. And I'm no longer married to my ideas, good or bad. I'm so much more flexible now. And I've enjoyed so much more collaboration and success as a result of that. So it's been a good life lesson for me.
Can I summarize that somehow? Like, you can stick to the goal, but not to the methods or to the path, how you go there, no?
Well said.
Yeah.
Well said.
Yeah.
Where previously it had to be my idea, and I fought hard to make bad ideas happen, and that's certainly the wrong path. Yeah.
Very, very wise. So let's see if we can save a little bit of lifetime applying just what you said. So... now, Pierre, it's your turn. So we both talked about completely different topics. We talked about your immense experience abroad in Asia in our briefing. Now, so you're originally from France and you spent incredible 16 years abroad in Asia. I have multicultural background myself. And yes, I now feel at home in several countries of the world. So I can absolutely understand that experience abroad is one of the best schools of life. Definitely, by far. So what are your top three key learnings from your time in Asia, and what do you apply today as you now lead a mostly German team in Hamburg as a French guy, let's say? No? Is that a challenge at all? Maybe not.
It is, believe me.
Okay, that was honest.
Of course, I mean, we need to be honest, right? And I think as leaders, we need to be in the vision, not in the drama. But I think what these, you know, looking to my last 16 years in Asia, before I came back to my continent of origin in end of 2019, I was 16 years in East Asia. I think what I learned there and what is tremendously helpful in this kind of environment right now is, and I would like to maybe make it an advice for people who want to follow the same path as I did when I was you know quite younger. I think the first thing is when you have the chance to go abroad and to live abroad, is to immerse yourself. Is to immerse yourself in the local culture and take everything not as a base of comparison with your own culture, but everything, every experience, even the bad ones, as a learning, as something that you can get the most out of it, right? And therefore, I think you come out of it by on top. In any kind of country, you enjoy it and you make it a resolute decision to enjoy, no matter comes your way, right? And to reflect and enjoy. And I think that's the first thing. I think being a minority and thriving as a minority is very important because it helps you to tremendously learn about yourself, about where you came from, and how you are perceived. Right, by others, because if you don't know how you are perceived, it's very difficult to work effectively with others, right? And that I think that helped me tremendously to take some distance from France, which is very often, you know, like where people tend to be sometimes, where the people who haven't had the chance that I had, right, to go abroad, to live abroad, tend to be more parochial, right, tend to be more you know, thinking just maybe in one particular framework and not embracing other people's point of view and cultures. And I think that living in Asia teaches you one thing, right? If you live successfully in Asia, it means that you have developed a certain sense of humility. Because the cultural framework there, the fact that these are high context cultures compared to low context cultures that are Western Europe, United States, you know, the creation of meaning is very complex in Asia. And very often you go from pitfall to pitfall to pitfall. You make all the possible mistakes as a Caucasian, right? Or let's say European or North American, because you don't understand. And the ability to really ask yourself, what is it that I don't know? What do I not know that I don't know, right? To be able to improve on yourself. And I think Asia is a good, in a way, mirror, if you will, to be able to reflect, hey, I did this. It led to that consequence. Why? Because in Europe, it would have happened that way, right? So I think this really, it builds a lot of humility and the ability to look at yourself in a very fresh way. I think that the other thing is Asia is a continent where probably is what struck me the most as a Westerner is that information is kept private, is kept hidden in a very ferocious manner. Information is power in Asia, much more than anywhere else. And you feel it, and it's built in the behavior of people. It's not that it makes them bad people or good people, it's just the way it is, right? And because it's a high context culture, the creation of meaning of a particular situation makes access to information all the more crucial to be successful. If you don't have information in a high context culture, you are lost. And the ability to partner with other people, to determine, and I think it's very important in the day and age where we live today, the ability to quickly determine the path of least resistance for a company, right? Among the very volatile, uncertain, you know, environment that we live in. This I built in my skills when I was in Asia. The ability to decipher an environment in a high context culture where the participation to a meaning of a particular situation is made of different factors that we don't consider in Europe or USA, right? And the ability to see, to gauge quickly where is the path of least resistance for a company, right? And to make a strategic priority out of it for a company, I think is tremendously helpful in this day and age. So when I came back to Europe, I think I applied all of this, right? The ability, especially as a French person working in Germany, right? You have to prove yourself continuously. You have to create that trust and credibility. And I think that the sense of humility, listening, right, where also in Asia is a continent where silence is not perceived as a weakness. Silence is actually perceived as, it's sometimes also a way to avoid losing control in front of others, right? And gaining credibility there, therefore, because if you lose control in front of others, then you're losing your face. I think that the combination of humility, listening, and the ability to determine in a very complex market the path forward is what I was able to bring back when I came back to Europe.
Actually, that what you just summarized now, also in the last sentence, now what you just said is really like something that you can apply personally, but something that you can also apply in leadership a lot. No? And once again, humility, and the less ego, the more you can learn and the more successful you can be, actually. So now, Christian, in our briefing, we had, again, completely different topics. So I heard really out from what you said, the following two challenges in your professional life. So on the one hand, you need to be a brilliant generalist and be able to quickly and easily understand a wide range of topics and really grasp also their impact on the business cases or on the market fields, etc. On the other hand, you need also to be an excellent networker, and that both internally and externally. So if you could now describe the top three mistakes that people usually make in networking, what would they be? Really, not what is done best, but what are the mistakes?
Sure, and what are the three main mistakes that I see? I would say the first one is if people are too transactional. And if what I mean with that is basically if you go into a conversation and you're purely focused on landing the job or making the sale, if you're just pursuing your own target, and that's, I think, very much perceived. I would be very, very much overwhelmed with that. I personally do not appreciate that, and I also do not recommend that. So if I go into an initial conversation, I typically always try to connect on a different level, and I don't talk products, technology, or sometimes I even don't talk business. It's more about offering your help and see how you can provide value. And that also means that you cannot expect an immediate return from that initial conversation. So that's one thing. And then the second mistake, I believe, that is quite often made is, so you have managed to have a good first initial contact, the first conversation, but then you are not properly following up. So you met somebody at the conference or at the meeting or somebody else. And I think the minimum you should really do is to properly follow up, but not just with a standardized LinkedIn message. You should really add a personalized message and really show that you really care about that connection and that you really care about that conversation. And once you have managed all that, I think the third mistake that you can make then, okay, say, okay, you have connected, you also followed up, it's all good. So it's one of your contacts, but it actually takes more to build relationship. So I think you really need to start spending more time and making sure that you build on that further. So it's really, I would say, prioritizing quality over quantity. Sometimes people are just connecting business cards and or LinkedIn connections, etc. But I would rather advise that you just focus on the very few people in your network where it really pays off to spend a little bit more time and to build a deeper relationship instead of, you know, connecting with hundreds or even thousands of people. So that's, I think, the main three mistakes that come into my mind. And overall, I would say, in particular, if you're in sales, you know, salespeople, as also Pierre mentioned, they don't like silence. So they always feel that they have to talk, right? Just to break the ice or whatsoever. And sometimes it's really better if you just, you know, pause and listen a little bit more and also talk less and pay a little bit more attention on what the other actually has to say. And then you can start asking, you know, thoughtful questions, etc. And also share a little bit more of your experience and perspectives. So that's, I think, the main topics. And I would never underestimate the point with the providing value. So as I said, it's really about how can you start, you know, making connections to others? How can you make introductions? How can you share industry knowledge, market knowledge with others? That's typically very much appreciated.
What is actually really nice that what you explained now on a very personal level, so between people, it's actually what Rockwell Automation does with the consulting approach, actually, that we mentioned also several times in the conversation. So that's exactly that. So first understand, and then maybe second or even third sell, whatever, you know, but first really understand and go deep with the customers. So, and now my last question of the panel is, and that goes really to all of you, what is your life motto? What guides you, inspires you, and motivates you? So, Ted, would you like to start?
Yeah, if I were to distill down my life philosophy, it is that I'm very deliberate. I chose this life. I made this life through a series of actions and decisions. And I try to live my life very deliberately. The people, the family, friends, colleagues, and customers get 100% of my focus. What I've brought into my life, what I take a responsibility for, the actions and activities that I do, I'm wholly invested. And really everything else, I don't worry about it. If I can't control it, it's not my problem. So I find a great deal of satisfaction out of everything that I just described because I'm so incredibly invested in all of the aspects of my life. And to finish that off, I look at my career as I'm getting towards the end of it. If I were to define success, I hope the people that I've worked with, the customers that I've worked for, would say that I was professional and successful. But really, more importantly, I would hope that they would say that was a good person. And I felt like there was a real connection there. And that they truly were personally invested in me and my success.
Actually, that's also something that stays usually, We know all this kind of research that people forget the project you worked on, the people forget what you talked about, but they will never forget how you made them feel. Eh?
The people.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Now, Pierre, your turn.
Very nice segue again into my view of what my life motto would be. I think that the people are at the heart of everything that I've been doing professionally and on a more personal standpoint. And I realized that the first time when I was given the responsibility of a few countries when I was working for my previous company. And it was three countries that have a very, a historical relationship to my home country, which is France. And these three countries were the former Indochina, right? So you have Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos. And I realized for the first time I was in charge of a team. I was in my early 30s. And I realized that it was not about just my success. It was that everybody was making me successful and I had to be making them successful in order to, so that they could reciprocate. And I think from that point on, I've developed a passion for people. And when I see, what our CEO is saying about this marriage between people and technology, right? Or enhancing human capability, which is the motto of Rockwell Automation. That technology plays an enabling role, but at the end, people are still the stars, right? I apply that every day in the way I am managing my teams. I 6 years ago, I decided to embark on a executive coach certification because I thought that people development goes hand in hand with more listening, less mentoring and more coaching, because one is exactly the opposite of the other, although we use the word interchangeably, increasingly so. And I discovered the power of coaching. And I'm using this not to just to be a better listener, but also to be able to ask the right questions so that people come up with their own solutions, right? Their own ideas, their own solutions to their development, because they adhere a lot better to their own solutions rather than to mine, right? And this is the opposite of mentoring. And I think that this is really what guides every step, every day when I wake up, I'm asking myself, what have I done for the people who are working with and for me, right? If there's really one spare hour, along with my passion for machine builders and so on, that's more on the professional side, but I would probably put the passion for people, the passion for developing, not just you know, describing a few individuals and dub them as talent and do everything for them, but rather see the entire enterprise as a collection of individuals who have, each and every one of them, a path ahead of them and a potential to develop, or a path towards, you know, developing their potential, and establishing that partnership between line management, HR. So there's the whole concept of workforce planning, but also individually for people and also for organizations, so that we place again the human back at the core of this transformation and this growth, right? Because if there's not in it something for people, right, is the essence of change management, then people won't drive the change. If you want the people to drive the change and to provide every element of your personal success, right, then you need to equip them with an understanding of what's in it for them. And again, change management, coaching, and people development are intimately intertwined. And that's again, I think that's my motto. I have a passion for people. I have a passion for developing people, for getting them, for understanding where they struggle, removing roadblocks, and making them hopefully better individual. And at the end of the day, like Tad said, you know, probably the best reward that you can get is have someone who comes and back and to tell you, you know what, you made an impact on my life. When that happens, you can have any technology or any new fad, technology fad, right, that comes your way. Mm-hmm. I think at the end, when I retire, that's what will remain with me. A collection of individuals that have risen, that have stepped up and played a dramatically different, you know, like much bigger roles in the company as when I, you know, first came into their professional life, right? And that's what animates me.
Really not maybe bigger roles, but that they discovered the roles that suit them best because of your help of coaching.
Correct.
So something that is really authentically there.
That's exactly what coaching is, right? Is to make people more than, so much more than what they already are. Not make them become the president of the United States, make them more than what they already are, because there's this extra potential that coaching helps reveal in a way.
Exactly. You can see that, but maybe them not. No? So that's exactly the point. Yeah. Super, super important. Yeah. Thank you very much. Christian, now your turn.
So I think I do not really have a real life motto. I think what I usually tell people is a little bit surprising. So for me, there is no work-life balance, if you want so. So everybody's talking and is really careful about the work-life balance. But for me, honestly, it's just really one life, and some meaningful work is part of this life, right? And I personally do not care too much about 9-to-5 or what other, you know, working models you might have. And it's really just a matter of how you properly balance that. And then I think it's no problem also to sometimes, you know, work on different hours if you counterbalance that on the other days, etc. So that's the first thing. In general, I would say the best ideas. So if I get stuck somewhere, if I need to find a solution to a complex topic, I find most of the inspirations not in front of my desk. I typically need to go outside, I don't know, in nature and do some sports. And then if I move, I typically have the good ideas, because that clears really up your mind. And I can really just, you know, advise to all people. So we are not meant to sit, you know, 14 hours straight or whatsoever, 8 hours straight in front of a desk. Sometimes it really just helps, you know, disconnect for 30 minutes, do a stroll in a park or whatsoever. And I think that can help a lot to be a little bit more creative and also thinking a little bit more outside of the box. Sometimes we are so trapped and so focused in certain patterns. And for me personally, if I go out, do my sports, and if I'm in nature, in a forest or whatsoever, that really helps to disconnect, but in a good way. Disconnecting means that you can be really, that you can develop different idea streams if you want so. In terms of my motivation, I would say it's really a good time to be in the automotive industry. I mean, in general, the automotive industry was always an exciting industry for me. I was really happy doing the move from oil and gas to automotive. But in particular, if we look back in the past 5 to 8 years, it's incredible what has happened to this industry and all the change. And it's just great every single day to be part of that, to support all those emerging startups And it's just a good time to work on this. And it's also nice if you know that, as I said before, doing some meaningful work, it's great if you keep that in mind, that what you do actually is also paving the way for hopefully a greener and more sustainable future, right? So this is the overarching topic again. And that is actually a very good reason for me to get up every day and motivates me.
And you made already one big choice very well, because you choose the right job that excites you, that gives you that energy, where you don't basically particularly need this kind of work-life balance that we talk so much about, etc. So, you know, not in the general understanding. So that is something that when you have meaningful work, when you have work that excites you really to get up in the morning and to start doing that, you really get energy and not lose it. So that's already the baseline. Huh? Yeah, Ted and Pierre are nodding. So yeah, let me summarize that. So first of all, I would like to thank you, Ted, Pierre and Christian. Thank you for not only sharing the technical insights on where Rockwell Automation currently stands on, but also we looked a little bit in the future. We looked a little bit at the current state, we looked a little bit on the dangers, we looked a little bit on the opportunities and so on. And we looked a lot about and talked a lot about collaborations and what you are looking for, etc. But also thank you for showing your human side. And actually, that's why I started this intro very differently, because I gave you the opportunity to show you right away from the beginning what you had to learn, to unlearn, and let's say to find common things with you, let's say all the three of you. Even you work together, I know, but I just guess that you never had a panel or a meeting together and where you were asked this kind of unusual question. So I hope that you will take that with you, and maybe in the next meeting or in the next business trip, etc., yeah, continue the conversations on the human level as well, which will deepen your level of understanding for each other, level of trust, and also your level of collaboration actually in the end. So I hope that it goes a long way. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ludmila.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
There are many ways to achieve a more sustainable future. There are many companies and innovative leaders who choose and actively go very different ways. Let's just not forget one thing. No matter how different the ways are, the big goal is one and the same. See you very soon in the next episode.